Oh, good evening, everybody. Let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation. And so, moment by moment, everything is coming into existence and ceasing. There's never any moment where things remain static or firm. They're always arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing. And so in this world, there's nothing stable or secure. And especially when things are arising and ceasing under the influence of ignorance, then definitely there's going to be problems, because ignorance misapprehends things, and ignorance begets all sorts of other mental afflictions. So instead of latching on to everything in this world as concrete and tangible and permanent and graspable, let's have a more realistic perspective of it rising and ceasing, not having any essence of its own. And so there being nothing to be attached to, nothing worth being attached to, including ourselves, because our own body is arising and ceasing with each moment, as is our mind. And these two are under the influence of ignorance. So rather than get attached to some kind of personal identity that we've made up with our ignorant mind, let's abide with an awareness that things are transient and that they don't have their own essence. And so therefore not take everything so seriously, make such a big deal about everything. Let's have a more playful attitude and an attitude of compassion for all the beings who suffer because of this ignorance. And so in that way, let's generate the wish to become a fully awakened Buddha for the benefit of self and others. So some people feel really down when they think about impermanence. Oh, everything's arising and ceasing. There's nothing I can hold on to. Oh. Yeah? But when you think about it, unawareness of impermanence gives us a tremendous amount of inner freedom. Because if we have the correct understanding of impermanence, then we don't mourn all those things that we can't hold on to. You know? We only want to hold on to them because we think that they're hold on toable. You know, that they're permanent in some way. But when we see that they aren't, then, you know, why want to hold on to something you can't hold on to? Yeah? It's like, oh. Do you remember when someone made that stuff that looked like chocolate pudding, but they put sesame powder in it, and it tasted ghastly. You know, do you remember that? Somebody's kitchen experiment. And when you look at it, oh, chocolate pudding, I want some. Craving, 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 I want, you know. And I want some now, and I hope there's leftovers so I can have some later. Mm-hmm. But once you tasted it, did you have any craving for it anymore?
No.
You know, before we thought there was something hold on toable in it, some delicious quality in it we could hold on to, some permanent essence in it to hold on to. When we tasted it, we realized that we had mistaken, you know, some ghastly thing for chocolate pudding, like the person who thinks a mirage is water, or that the face in the mirror is a real face, yeah, or that the ghost in the hologram is a real ghost. You know, our perception was completely inaccurate. You know, when we realized that our perception was inaccurate and that there was nothing delicious in there, we didn't sit there and go, oh, that's really too bad that wasn't chocolate pudding. You know, I really wanted it to be chocolate pudding. Can't we make it into chocolate pudding? You know, we didn't do that, did we? We didn't mourn it or anything. We just dropped it like a hot potato. In fact, I was amazed they kept putting it out at medicine meal until finally somebody, some unknowing person, must have finished it off. Well, it's the same thing here. You know, when we see things are impermanent, then there's nothing to mourn in it, because there was nothing ever there that you could hold on to. Okay, are you seeing what I'm meaning? Yeah? So you just drop it. Oh, there's nothing there to hold on to. So, yeah, so you drop it, and then you just become more attuned to the fact that things are changing in every moment. And I heard one Buddhist teacher say, I guess she was holding a cup, and she said, oh, I relate to the cup like it's already broken. Yeah? So if we have an awareness that, you know, the fact of it being already broken, that's the gross impermanence. The subtle impermanence is it changing moment by moment until the actual gross impermanence happens and it's broken. But if we relate to this as it's already broken, then when it breaks, we're not going to freak out. But if we relate to it as something solid and concrete, then when it breaks, we're going to go, huh, you know, what happened to my cup? That wasn't supposed to happen. Okay? So sometimes while we're building things at the Abbey, I sit there and I think, you know, we're designing a building that's in the process of coming into existence and going out of existence at the same time. You know, we're designing and building a building that is going to fall apart. Of course, we're going to try and make it fall apart as late as possible and construct it well. But, you know, to not fool ourselves that we're creating something that is concrete. Even if we make it out of concrete, it's not concrete, is it? Okay, so things are rising and ceasing all the time. And if we accept that, then it's much easier for us to live in the world. We don't have so much clinging and craving and grasping and grief, you know, when things cease. And especially if the things that are arising and ceasing are under the influence of afflictions and karma, then there's really nothing there worthwhile. Yeah? Because who wants to hold on to something that was created by ignorance? You know, His Holiness says even the word ignorance is unappealing. Yeah? Isn't it? Yeah, it's like, ignorant. It's not a word that gives you a good feeling. Yeah? And so, you know, things created under the influence of ignorance, why hold on to them and expect things from them that they can't deliver? Okay? So this is not something to mourn. This is just reality, you know. There's no sense mourning reality. Reality is what it is, okay? And the more we attune our mind to reality, then the happier and more satisfied we're going to be. The more we fight with reality and want reality to be different, the more miserable we're going to be. Okay? So, you know, this whole theme of impermanence comes up again and again in Buddhist teachings. And tonight we're going to start off talking about some quotations that talk about impermanence. And impermanence is one of the chief reasons why we develop renunciation. You know, because if everything in this world is arising and ceasing, then there's nothing to hold on to that's stable and secure. And if all those worldly things are, you know, come into existence due to ignorance, then there's definitely nothing to hold on to. You know, the Buddha's qualities, the paths and stages, they don't come into existence based on ignorance and karma. But, you know, all the rest of the things we get attached to sure do. Yeah. And so when we realize this, then we kind of let it go. Okay? Now, before we get into all this stuff about ignorance, since the conversation about the three doors to liberation was such a big hit last week, I don't know if it was with the online audience, but here people were discussing it quite a bit. I thought to give you the Pali perspective on the three doors, okay? Because you can see that there's some similarity, but there's also some difference. And I find it quite interesting, you know, to see these different approaches to different words and concepts, okay? So in the Pali tradition, in the fundamental vehicle, they say liberations are states of mind that realize nirvana, okay? And so there's three kinds of liberation: signless liberation, wishless liberation, and empty liberation, okay? So, and they're one nature, but they are differentiated based on the aspect of nirvana that they're focused on. Okay, so they all come down to the same point, but we're looking at nirvana through different aspects when we think of these three liberations. So signless liberation sees nirvana as being free from the signs of conditioned existence. So conditioned existence are things that are under the influence of causes and effect that arise and cease moment by moment. And signless liberation sees that nirvana is free of the signs of being a conditioned phenomena. In other words, nirvana is unconditioned. It's permanent. It doesn't arise. It doesn't cease. Okay? So it's something more stable than all the fleeting things in this world. Okay? So that's looking at nirvana from it being free of the signs of conditioned existence. Wishless liberation sees nirvana as being free from clinging and craving. Okay? We're not wishing for anything. So there's no clinging, no craving. So nirvana, another way of looking at nirvana is the freedom from clinging and craving. Wouldn't that be nice? To have a mind that is free from clinging and craving. Where you had a mind that could just let things be. Yeah. Our mind can't let things be. We always are clinging to them, craving to them, wanting to line them up so that we'll always have them and they won't go away. You know, we can't just let things be. So this creates a lot of aggravation on our part. Okay, then empty liberation sees nirvana as being empty of a self or any kind of substantial entity. Okay, so nirvana is not some kind of self. It's not a person. It's not an inherent nature. Okay, it's not some substantial identity that we can find when we look for it. Okay, so we see these three ways of looking at nirvana, that it's free from the signs of conditioned existence, it's free from craving and clinging, and it's free from being a self or a substantial identity. Okay. Now, since there's three liberations, then there's three doors to reach those liberations. And each door to those liberations is an aspect of insight. Okay? So insight or vipassana. And it's particularly related to the three characteristics. In the Pali tradition, we talk about three characteristics: impermanence, dukkha, or unsatisfactory nature, and no self, or selflessness, okay? And so each of those three correspond with insight into one of those three characteristics, okay? So insight into impermanence is the door to the signless liberation, because it removes all signs of conditioned phenomena, so that the undeclining, undisintegrating nature of nirvana can shine forth. Okay? So when we meditate on impermanence, yeah, we see that things are rising and ceasing, that completely removes all signs of conditioned existence, in the sense that we see that nirvana is a completely different kind of phenomena. Yeah, it's not something that arises due to cause and conditions. It's not something that's momentarily disintegrating. Yeah, so having insight into impermanence connects us with the signless liberation that sees nirvana as free from the signs of conditioned phenomena, and that lets the undeclining, undisintegrating, unconditioned nature of nirvana shine forth. Okay, so nirvana is often called the unconditioned. It's called, you know, it's called the deathless. It's without all this conditioned permanent stuff. Okay? Then insight into dukkha, or the unsatisfactory or suffering nature, is the door to wishless liberation. Since knowing the unsatisfactory nature of conditioned phenomena completely stops any wish or desire for them. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the wishless liberation sees nirvana as free from clinging and craving. Okay? Because we've had insight into the nature of dukkha of things, and so then there's no clinging and craving for them. Yeah. You see something as suffering in nature. If you see that even though it looks like chocolate pudding, it tastes dreadful, you don't cling, okay? So the mind has that freedom, yeah? And then insight into no self, or insight into selflessness, is the door to empty liberation, because it reveals that since there's no conditioned phenomena that has a substantial identity, we can't even think of an unconditioned phenomena being encumbered by a substantial identity. Okay? So when we meditate on no self, then we see that nothing has any substantial identity. It's not a self, or it's not an object owned by the self. It doesn't have its own essence. Okay? And so if a conditioned phenomena is like that, then definitely an unconditioned phenomena isn't going to have some kind of essence. Yeah, because an unconditioned phenomena is something, you know, that's a negation, it's an absence of something. So if the positive phenomena doesn't have an essence, then its absence definitely isn't going to either. Okay? So in all three cases, the correct understanding of conventionalities, of conditioned phenomena, cuts through the mental fabrications of permanence, of purity, of pleasure, of self, and reveals the unconditioned, reveals the nirvana. Okay? And so the way that we come to realize the unconditioned, or nirvana, is through understanding the conditioned phenomena correctly. Okay? Because in each of these three things, to understand that door to selfless, understand that door to liberation, we had to have insight into some aspect about conditioned phenomena, that either it was impermanent, or it was the nature of dukkha, or it was selfless. So by understanding that those characteristics of conditioned things, then we come to understand the unconditioned. Okay, through using conventionalities, we come to understand the ultimate. And what I find very interesting in this is that there's a quotation in Nagarjuna's Treatise on the Middle Way. I didn't have a chance to look it up and quote it, but a quotation where he talks about you have to use conventionalities to understand the ultimate. So it relates very much to that quotation. But interestingly, the Mahayana often interpret that quotation in a slightly different way, not in a contradictory way, but it's just interesting to see, you know, that same point interpreted in two different ways. Okay, but what this helps us to understand is that nirvana is not some kind of isolated absolute entity. Yeah, it's not some kind of substantial thing for us to grasp onto. And that's very, very important for us to understand. Otherwise, we just want to transfer all of our craving and clinging to nirvana. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I'm done with the chocolate pudding, but what about the chocolate chip cookies? You know, just, changing the object of our craving and clinging. But that doesn't get us anywhere. Okay? Okay. So now we're going to continue where we left off in the author's introduction. And by the way, you know, our author, the Mongolian Geshe, Losang Taiyang, I think he's the same one who wrote the 108 verses on compassion. Yeah? Because the author of that text was a Mongolian Geshe named Losang Taiyang. So I don't know how many Mongolian Geshes named Losang Taiyang there are, but, you know, I think they may be the same one. So where we stopped last week, our author was quoting Nagarjuna's Treatise on the Middle Way, okay? And it was chapter 18, verse 8. And the quotation from Nagarjuna is, all, in parentheses, phenomena are real, unreal, real and unreal, and not real or unreal. This is what Buddha taught. Okay? So here we have what's called the tetralemma, four options of something. Okay? So all phenomena are real. That's one option. Second option, unreal. That's the first line. Second line, both real and unreal. That's the third option. And then the third line, and not real or unreal. That's the fourth option. This is what the Buddha taught. So it's one of those things that make you scratch your head and go, what in the world is he talking about, okay? So let's look what it's talking about. Okay, first of all, the Buddha is a very skillful teacher, and he teaches according to what sentient beings are capable of understanding, yeah? And he leads them to the ultimate view in a very skillful way. So he doesn't start out with the ultimate view because, you know, or the full explanation of the ultimate view, because people wouldn't get it. Okay, he starts out explaining things in a, you know, by agreeing with certain things that people already believe in and affirming their beliefs and so on. And in that way, he wins their trust and confidence. Okay, remember last week I was talking about how when you talk about Buddhism to somebody who's a non-Buddhist, you talk about what the things you have in common and what they already agree with, and then that's a skillful way. Then they begin to trust you and realize you're not a lunatic, and then they might want be interested in learning more. Okay? So the Buddha, too, when he taught sentient beings, yeah, he explained the world, you know, according to the cosmology that was very popular at that time. Yeah, he didn't explain something new. He wasn't, you know, Galileo did, and look what happened to him. So, you know, it wasn't that the Buddha was chicken. It was more that he wanted to be able to explain the ultimate nature rather than, you know, freaking everybody out. So he explained the cosmology according to how the Indians thought. And he explained the categories of phenomena in that way. And because ordinary people see that, you know, see things are real and think and see that things are basically rather static and permanent, he taught according to that view. You know, and he said, yeah, things have a truly existent essence, and, you know, okay, maybe at the end of the day they die and go out of existence, but he didn't talk about subtle impermanence or anything like that. You know, he talked instead about normal things that people could understand and agree with. Okay? In that way, he won over their trust and confidence. Then, so that's when it says in the first line, all phenomena are real. That means that what the Buddha taught, you know, is that he taught that they are real in the sense that they don't change moment by moment. Okay? He said they are impermanent because their continuity ceases. And we can see that, you know, the flame of the lamp runs out, the gas tank gets emptied, okay? So we can see that the continuum of some things cease. But he didn't teach subtle impermanence. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what it means in the first line. All phenomena are real. It means the Buddha taught in accordance with the way people saw things. Okay? Then, after he had won their confidence, then he introduced the idea that they're unreal. So that's in the first line, the word unreal. And here's what he said, is that things, not only are conditioned things, do conditioned things have an end, their continuity has an end, or most of them do, not all of them, their continuity ceases, but they're actually changing moment by moment. Okay, and so in the sense that because they're changing moment by moment, then he said they're unreal. Because if you think about it, something that is arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing, arising and ceasing, yeah, they're not so solid and real. They're kind of ethereal a little bit, aren't they? There's nothing there you can really hold on to. Yeah. So that's the unreal in the first line. Okay. Then sentient beings got used to that. Oh, okay. These things are changing. They're transient. They don't endure until the next moment. Then he taught the second line, which is the third alternative, real and unreal. Okay. And so here, what he said is that according to the childish beings who don't know anything, who don't meditate, who don't think about reality or philosophy or anything, according to them, things are real. But they're unreal and false from the perspective of an Arya's post-meditation time. You know, the mind of an Arya after they've arisen from meditation on selflessness. Okay? So there, so these things that are, that these conditioned things, yeah, these impermanent things, they're real for the childish because they don't appear to change in the next moment. But they're unreal for an Arya who has direct perception of impermanence. Because when that Arya comes out of their meditation of having the direct perception of impermanence, when they look at these things, they don't hold them as real anymore. Okay? So the second line, which is the third alternative, real and unreal, is talking about both perspectives together, but differentiating how the childish and how the Aryas see things. Okay? Then okay, so that gave people more to think about. Okay, you look at it this way, it's real. Look at it this way, it's unreal. Which way is really true? You know, which way is more accurate? And so then he continued teaching. And when people were ready for it, then he said, well, actually, you know, both permanent things and impermanent things are empty of inherent existence. So both permanent things are unreal, okay, or both are unreal. Okay, put it this way. Okay, both the unreal things that change into something else in the next moment don't have inherent existence. And the real things, those things that are permanent, they're also empty of inherent existence. Okay, so that's the neither option, because neither of them are graspable. You know, neither of them are inherently existent. Okay, so do you see the progression, how the Buddha taught? First, you know, oh yeah, everything's normal, don't worry, everything's truly existent, it's permanent. Then, oh, these things aren't permanent, or these things aren't real because they're disintegrating every moment. Then, well, if you're a childish being, they're real from that perspective. But if you're an Arya who has direct perception of emptiness or a direct perception of impermanence, then these things aren't real. And then, well, you know, whether it's a permanent, whether it's a conditioned phenomena or an unconditioned phenomena, whether it's a permanent phenomena or an impermanent phenomena, neither one of them are truly existent. Neither one of them have an inherent essence. Okay? So that way he explained that tetralemma. So that's the meaning of that verse there. Okay? Then the author quotes Arya Deva's treatise on the 400 stanzas. Okay? And the way that verse was translated here, I didn't like so much. And so I looked at, it was very confusing. So Ruth Sonam, who translated it according to Geshe Sonam Rinsen's explanation, who explained it according to Gyaltsebze, she has a much clearer translation of the verse. So it's verse 195 in the 400 stanzas. Okay? So the verse reads, teaching existence, non-existence, both existence and non-existence, and neither, surely are medicines for all that are influenced by the sickness. Okay? So here again we have a tetralemma. Okay? Existence, non-existence, both existence and non-existence, and neither existence nor non-existence. And surely all of these, they are all medicines for beings who are influenced by the sickness of ignorance. Okay, so let's look at this verse in a little bit more depth. The first line, teaching existence, okay, to guide others and to eliminate the view that nothing exists, the Buddha taught existence. Okay, and so here existence is meaning true existence, or it could also just mean general existence, because there were people at the time of the Buddha who said nothing exists. You know, it all is a dream. Not it's like a dream, it is a dream, so nothing exists. Yeah. Okay. Or nothing truly exists, therefore nothing exists whatsoever. So to counteract that wrong view, then the Buddha taught true existence. Okay? Because it's much more dangerous to have a nihilistic view than it is to have an absolutist view. If you have a nihilistic view that things don't exist, or karma doesn't exist, or ethical conduct doesn't exist, you know, then you really can go down the wrong path and do all sorts of negative actions. But whereas somebody, even if they think that things are truly existence and have an absolutist view, still they will honor karma and its effects and refrain from non-virtue. Okay? So first, to keep people from falling to that nihilistic, very destructive view, the Buddha taught existence. Okay, then to eliminate the innate self-grasping ignorance that some beings suffer from, then he said there's no true existence. And so that's in the first line, the word non-existence. Okay, so first he taught, yeah, it all exists, it truly exists. Yeah, so that's better than nihilism. Then he said, actually, there's no true existence whatsoever. Yeah. Then the second line, it says both existence and non-existence. So in relationship to a conventional, so here existence and non-existence are being explained in terms of the kind of cognizer that understands them. Okay, so things are not totally non-existent. In other words, in line two, both existence. Okay, they're not totally non-existent because they're validly ascertained by a reliable cognizer. Okay, so in order to keep people from going to the extreme that things are totally non-existent, he taught existence. Why do they exist? Because they can be apprehended by a reliable cognizer. Okay, so that's in relationship to conventional reliable cognizers. In relationship to a conventional awareness, we establish conditioned phenomena and things that arise and cease and function, and you and me and chocolate pudding and so on, okay? But then he also said that they're non-existent. Yeah, this is in line two. Non-existent because those same things are that we just said are found by a reliable conventional cognizer are not found under ultimate analysis. So from the perspective of a mind that is searching for how things really exist, for their ultimate mode of being, nothing is findable. And so that's what non-existence means in that second line. Okay? You can't find an ultimate findable way of mode of existence or entity or anything when you look with ultimate analysis. Okay? So here, you know, with a conventional reliable cognizer, we establish conventionalities, so things are not totally non-existent. But they aren't completely truly existent either, or in any way truly existent, because when we look for some true entity about them with ultimate analysis, we can't find anything. So they're non-existent from that perspective. Okay? Then, again in line two, it says neither. So what neither means is to eliminate the grasping at the two extreme views. One, absolutism, that things are truly existent. The other, nihilism, that nothing whatsoever exists whatsoever at all. Then the Buddha taught that both impermanent things, conditioned things, and permanent things, also called non-things, or unconditioned phenomena, that neither of those are truly existent. Okay? So here he's saying that, you know, when you really look and try and find some nature in both things and non-things, in both permanent and impermanent things, you can't find any truly existent essence. And so that's the extreme of neither. And so this is explaining how they exist from the ultimate viewpoint. Okay? So, you see again here how the Buddha was very skillful, leading beings, oh yeah, they're truly existent, don't worry, don't fall in nihilism. No, they're not truly existent. Don't grasp onto them. But then some people, you know, still might fall to nihilism. So then he says, well, they're both existent and non-existent because from a conventional viewpoint they exist. They're perceived by a conventional valid cognizer. But they're non-existent because from a valid cognizer apprehending the ultimate, nothing, you can't find them. Okay? And then neither means that this applies to both conditioned and unconditioned things. Yeah. So all phenomena, yeah, whatever there is, none of it is truly existent. But none of it is totally non-existent either. And so that's the middle way view. And so the last two lines in the verse say that all these above four are surely are medicines for all that are influenced by the sickness. So all the sentient beings who are influenced by the sickness of ignorance that misapprehends the nature, all these different viewpoints, which seem to be contradictory, yeah. It's not that the Buddha's contradicting himself. It's not that he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's not that he's changing his mind. It's that he's teaching these different viewpoints in a particular order according to where sentient beings are on the path and what viewpoint is going to help them at any particular time. So all these views are medicine. Hmm? So when we understand this, you know, it's very important because then we know how to, you know, put in a schema all the different teachings that the Buddha gave. Because he did sometimes say different things to different people. And if you're going to try and take him literally each time, then it seems like he's contradicting himself. But if you understand that these are all medicines for different levels of sickness, then you really see the Buddha's skill. Okay? The same thing applies. We have this kind of joke. We always had this thing when I lived in India. Lama says, okay, so about anything that there was, you know, people couldn't discuss amongst each other. It was always Lama said X, Y, and Z. Lama said to do this. Lama said to do that. But it got really confusing because Lama said different things to different people. But, you know, us with our minds that were completely rigid, you know, all somebody had to do was say Lama said, and we took that as God's truth and applied it to every person in all situations at all times. It created some problems. Yeah, because it wasn't meant for all people at all times in all situations. Okay? And then, of course, when somebody else comes along and says, well, Lama says blah, 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 which was the opposite, then people go, oh, this first guy didn't know what they were talking about. It's really this. And then everything flip-flops to this other thing, which they interpret just as literally for all people in all situations at all times. Okay. Meanwhile, poor Lama is sitting there going, boy, you know, these people are really misunderstanding me. There was this one really funny incident one time. where there was a groundskeeper at Vajrayogini Institute named Tony. And Tony loved Lama Yeshe. He, you know, Tony just had this incredible devotion for Lama and wanted to follow Lama's advice to the T and really do what pleased Lama. So one year, you know, Lama doesn't stay in the centers very long. He comes for a while and then goes on. So one year when he was visiting, he said to Tony, "Oh, it'd be beautiful to have flowers everywhere, you know, at the institute." So Lama left. And so then Tony, you know, bless his heart, because he had a good motivation, goes to the director and said, "Lama says he wants flowers all over. So, you know, I need a budget to spend, you know, how many hundreds or thousands of francs to buy all the flowers because Lama says we should have flowers everywhere." Well, this created a little bit of discord in the center because there wasn't very much money and the director had other ideas of how the money should be spent besides on flowers which bloom and die. Yeah? So there was this whole big, you know, conversation and discord, blah, 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 blah. And then finally, I don't know whether it was Lama coming the next year or somebody called Lama or what it was. But anyway, Lama clarified what he meant was, in Tibet, we just take flower seeds and we just sprinkle them. And where flowers grow, they grow. And where they don't grow, they don't grow. So you don't need to, you know, because Tony, bless his heart, wanted to till everything and plant everything and fertilize everything and, to, you know, so it was going to take all the time of the volunteers, all the money of the center, you know. And Lama said, "But in Tibet, we just throw it and they grow." Yeah? So it was a very good example of, you know, how not to get attached to Lama says. Yeah? But to really think, you know, okay, well, what could he have really meant? And in what situation is this applicable to? And to what people? And how does it fit into the big situation? Okay? You know, in the same way that Achen Cha tells the story of if somebody's walking on a narrow road and there's cliffs on each side, if somebody's too close to the right, the guide says, "Go left, go left." But if somebody's too close to the left, the guide says, "Go right, go right." Now, if you don't take it in context, you think the guide is completely contradicting. Saying go left, then he's saying go right. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. But if you realize it's different situations and different people, then it all makes sense. Okay, so it's the same way when Buddha's giving teachings. Okay, now, having said that, we should not then, when we come across some aspect of the Dharma that our ego doesn't like, say, "Well, Buddha didn't really mean this. He meant and just happens to be our own egotistical belief that we made up." Okay. So having said this, that, you know, we have to relativize everything, it doesn't mean that we can just take everything and reinterpret it according to how we want to see it. You know, because then we would say, "Oh, well, the Buddha said, you know, lying is non-virtue. But what he really meant was, you know, for politicians and CEOs, he wasn't really talking to common people, you know. And for those of us who were abused and taken advantage of by the system, he didn't mean that we shouldn't lie, you know, because he realized that we're being taken advantage of. And if we can get our equal rights by lying, then we should do it." You see? I mean, our mind can take anything and twist it, can't it? Can't we? Yeah? Make lying completely okay. Because I want to lie. Yeah? So, so we should be careful. That's what I'm saying. Okay. Then, I just want to finish this introduction here. Okay, then he quoted another verse from Ashbagosha's essay on the stages of cultivating the ultimate mind of enlightenment. And Ashvaghosha said, however, the compassionate one, abiding in the mode of the two truths and thoroughly depending on conventionalities, proclaims selfless in, I think means selflessness, in the great voice of a lion. Through synonyms such as emptiness, in parentheses, suchness, final reality, and so forth, limitless examples such as the likeness with a magician's illusions, dreams and mirages, and so forth, and the skillful means of a variety of vehicles, Buddha made known the meaning of the middle way, not abiding in any gross or subtle extremes. Okay, so the compassionate one, the Buddha, abiding in the mode of realizing the two truths, the conventional mode of existence and the ultimate mode of existence, and by thoroughly depending upon conventionalities. So he depended, both in the Pali way about understanding the nature of conventionalities to get at the ultimate, and he also depended on conventionalities because he taught the view of the ultimate through using words and concepts, which all have to do with conventionalities. Okay? But through using conventionalities, he proclaimed selflessness in the great voice of a lion. So the lion's roar that shatters all the untruths of the little foxes who have wrong views. Okay, so how did the Buddha teach with his great lion's roar? Through synonyms such as emptiness, suchness, final reality, and so forth. So he taught, various synonyms and how each word was referring to the same thing, but from a different perspective. He used limitless examples and syllogies and similes, such as a magical illusion, dreams, mirages, reflection in a mirror, echo. And in that kind of way, he taught how conventionalities are false. Okay. And another way the Buddha taught was the skillful means of a variety of vehicles. So according to sentient beings' aspiration and disposition, whether they aspired for personal peace, whether they aspired for, full awakening, then he taught the hearer vehicle, solitary realizer vehicle, bodhisattva vehicle. Okay? And so in all these ways, through synonyms, examples, and skillful means, he made known the meaning of the middle way. And the middle way is not abiding in any gross or subtle extremes. When we hear the middle way, we often get the idea that here's absolutism and here's nihilism, and you average them out and cut them in the middle, and that's the middle way. Actually, that's not the middle way. It's not that things are a little bit non-existent, a little bit this, and you mix them together. It's the middle way is something completely removed from both extremes. It's not part one extreme and part the other. It's something completely removed from both of them. Okay, and then Gyatso Losang Thayan continued. Within the Mahayana, there are two vehicles: the causal perfection vehicle, that sometimes or the far-reaching vehicle, Paramitayana, and the effect vehicle, the Vajra vehicle. Okay, Tantrayana, Vajrayana. I will express briefly a presentation of the grounds and paths of the three vehicles. Okay, here, solitary realizer and bodhisattva, in the system of the first of those, the perfection vehicle, in accordance with the uncommon mode of assertion of the glorious prasangika, the great, thoroughly non-abiding majjhimas, the very peak of all proponents of tenets of the great and small vehicles. Okay, so what he's saying is he's going to teach about the here, solitary realizer, and bodhisattva paths and grounds according to the perfection vehicle, the paramitayana, not according to the vajrayana, okay, but according to the perfection vehicle. And he's doing it in accordance with the philosophical system of the prasangika madhyamikas because they are the most accurate philosophical system. Okay? They're the peak of all the proponents of tenets. Okay, so all those who have philosophical views, the Prasangika are the peak. With respect to that, now he's going to give us the outline. There are two parts. The first one, explaining the presentation of the grounds and paths generally, and the second one, briefly investigating the limits of privation, beginning from the mode of assertion of objects of abandonment and antidotes. And of the first of those, the general presentation of the paths and grounds, has two parts. First, the presentation of the grounds and paths of the fundamental vehicle, and second, the presentation of the grounds and paths of the Mahayana. Okay, so that, there he's outlining a text, and this is very common in Tibetan texts. They give you the outlines like this. So when we turn the page where it says part one, you know, that's what we're doing, the presentation of the presentation of the grounds and paths generally. So part one is the fundamental vehicle grounds and paths. And so that's what we will start when we come back. Okay? In the meantime, you know, take some time and think about this whole thing with impermanence. And how the Buddha taught. And look at phenomena in these ways as existent, non-existent, both and neither. And do that. It's quite interesting. Okay? We have time for a couple of questions. Anybody has anything? Yeah.
The three doors of liberation are part of the 37 harmonies?
Are the three doors of liberation part of the 37 harmonies? No.
Oh, okay.
But you use the meditations and the qualities you develop in the 37 harmonies to realize the three doors of liberation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you said that the middle way is something totally different from the two extremes,
mm-hmm.
you still have to work with those two extremes to get at this different.
Yeah.
Sure what the relationship is.
Okay. When we say that the middle way is something completely different from the two extremes, we do discover the middle way by understanding it's not the extreme of absolutism and it's not the extreme of nihilism.
Mm-hmm. So then, since this text is taught from the Prasangika view, even when he talks about the fundamental vehicle, it will be from the Prasangika.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
When the Buddha taught these four ways to the people that lived in his world at the time, did he take... Was it on a one-to-one, whoever was in front of them he taught, or did he actually bring people along through the understandings as they continued to receive teaching?
Mm.
How did he actually do this?
Okay. Yeah. So with the four ones, how did he actually do this in a practical sense? Well, I could imagine him, you know, to different audiences, teaching according to the general view, or the predominant view, or the predominant disposition or need of a particular audience, and according to what they needed at that time, and then to a different audience saying something different because they were at a different place in the path. But I could also imagine as he was one, you know, going around, or if you look at the Mahayanas, he was appearing in different universes and different places, he might encounter the same beings who had practiced what he taught them before, who were now further along the path, and then give them the next step.
And so that when we have our teachers of this world teaching the Buddha's teachings, it's not a common practice for our teachers to start in the same way teaching us that things are true, are real and unreal. I mean, you
mm-hmm.
teach us what the understandings of what they are.
Yeah.
But we're not led in the same way in our
yeah.
minds.
Well, right now, but when we get it, we study the four tenet systems.
Right.
So we're getting all four views in sequence. But we're getting them all within a relatively short period of time. It's not like we've necessarily mastered the first, the Vaibhasika view before we learn the Satantrika view. Mm-hmm. However, you know, what's very helpful, even though you're under, you know, you're studying the tenets and you're getting a lot of information, you know, is to, you know, really be a Vaibhasika when you're studying the Vaibhasikas. And really stay there. And if we had all the time in the world, our teacher would just maybe teach us the Vaibhasikas for a year or two, you know, or 5 years or three lifetimes, and then later on teach us the Satantrikas. But I think they see that nowadays it's better give all the information, plant all those seeds. But, you know, when we're trying to really understand the nature of phenomena, you know, via Vaibhasika and really see the world in that way for a while. Mm-hmm. And if you do, then when you learn the Satantrika, then you look back and think, oh, well, yeah, that used to make sense, but, you know, it doesn't really make sense now that I look at things this way.
Because, you know, for my mind that sees things truly existent and doesn't even see them on a conventional level, you know, that's the first part, is for me to understand that what I'm seeing is I'm misapprehending. So I'm not going to have somebody teach me that what you're seeing is truly true existence.
Like, yeah.
That's
Okay. Well, see, you know, you've heard the Prasangika from the beginning, so you already think, oh, yeah, what I'm seeing, you know, doesn't exist in the way it appears, but we really don't have any idea of what that actually means, you know. So we start out being a Vipassaka, and we don't question those appearances.
Okay.
Yeah. But we start questioning other things when we learn the Vipassaka view.
Okay.
And then slowly, as we learn one system after the other, we begin to question more and more of our view.
So just to make sure I'm understanding, so when we're talking about the middle way, and then talking about when you were saying on one side is like nihilist, and then kind of the other side is absolutism, and so that other side would be like the teaching that things are real, and absolutism.
Yeah.
And there are the other three, the not real, the both real and not real, and neither real or unreal. Are those three all part of the middle way?
No, the real would be the extreme of absolutism. The unreal would be... Well, we have to, because both those quotations are different. It's a little bit, it's maybe don't put it in that framework.
Okay.
But when he says things are real or exist, you know, that's the extreme of absolutism. Okay, just be aware of that. And he said that at the beginning because maybe some people were just saying, well, nothing exists whatsoever. Okay. But all those different views are helping us to counter both extremes. But it doesn't mean that all those different views are one or the other of the extremes. Okay?